Please note that this episode contains graphic descriptions of violence, racism, and sexual assault, which listeners may find disturbing. So please take care while you listen. This episode was recorded in March 2023.
Rohingya men, women, and children have been fleeing their homes for 40 years. They're now almost entirely in exile. The tipping point was in August 2017, when nearly 700,000 were wrung from Myanmar in a single military operation. Over 5 years later, and the fate of the Rohingya still hangs in the balance. Recently, the World Food Programme has cut life-saving food aid for Rohingya refugees, and a huge fire in the Cox's Bazar camp in Bangladesh has left an estimated 12,000 without shelter. Welcome to Afterwords. I'm Amelia Gentleman, a writer and reporter for The Guardian, joined today with author and fellow Guardian journalist Kamil Ahmed. His book, I Feel No Peace, is the first book-length exploration of Rohingya lives abroad, drawing on hundreds of hours of interviews and long-standing relationships within the diaspora. Hi, Kamil. So I'm hoping perhaps you could start a bit by telling us how you became interested in the situation in Myanmar and the Rohingya. You touch on it right at the beginning of the book when you describe hearing an unfamiliar Bengali dialect on Al Jazeera.
Yeah, I think the first kind of place I came across the Rohingya was watching news reports on Al Jazeera. It's not a Bengali dialect, but a language very similar to Bengali, but also quite strange. And I was still at university at that time, and understanding that borders and nations didn't necessarily fit into the same boxes that we have now. And so seeing, especially when Bangladesh, where my parents are from, has this quite strong identity around its language, that was what led to the roots of its independence movement. And then you have a people who seem quite similar, but are rejected by Bangladesh, but are also rejected by Myanmar, the country where they say they've always been from. And it intrigued me that there were people who were lost between these borders and these ideas of what nationhood or statehood is. It was just kind of surprising to see a people who seemed so familiar but are rejected by everyone. And they were on boats and being pulled back out to sea and left to sea, or being turned back from borders. I was just very curious. And Al Jazeera was the only real kind of international media outlet regularly doing some reports on them at the time. There would be occasional reports in other media. So I really wanted to know more about them. A couple of years later, when I started as a journalist, I was working for a Turkish news agency and I was covering South Asia. So I started working with reporters in the region to start getting more reports, to get more information about what is happening, especially from Myanmar and a few from Bangladeshi refugee camps. This was also around the time of the 2012 riots. So disputes in Rakhine State spilled over into a much bigger conflict where Rohingya were massively targeted by local groups, by extremist groups and the military, and basically forced out of their homes. So it was really significant change in the dynamic there. As I later found out, this had been happening for decades, but that was a real kind of big point where things change. And I think it's around the time that people start talking about genocide is around 2012.
So that's what's so well explained in your book, is the really long back history of this persecution. I think many people only really learned about the Rohingya and their suffering after the atrocities in August 2017. And yet they've been fleeing their homes for decades before. Could you try and give us a potted summary of this untold history?
You can go back to just after independence, just after the Second World War. I did meet a man who in the 50s had been to Bangladesh as a refugee. So you can go back to the 40s and 50s, but things aren't so bad until they're not good, but perhaps not necessarily much worse than for other minorities in Myanmar until the 60s and the big changes in the 70s. And in 78, under military dictatorship, there is a operation called Nagamin, which is like called a population counting exercise, but it's the checking of Rohingya documents and arresting of people who are deemed to have been intruders. And I think that's the kind of big theme behind it, is that these Rohingya are intruders and we need to root them out. And that terrifies people. And so that's the first time tens of thousands of Rohingya go to Bangladesh and they seek refuge here. And that's the first time big camps form on the Bangladeshi border with Myanmar.
And where did this classification of them as intruders come from?
In a way, it comes from this idea of what the nation is and who is, and I think enforcing or forging one nation is something quite common in post-independent states, especially ones that are multi-ethnic. They're trying to fuse together so many different types of people and say, you are now Myanmar or Turkey or India. And often one type seems to dominate everything else. But with the same case of the Rohingya, they are by that point deemed to not be one of the ethnicities that are wanted. And some of the language behind this is about them being Muslim and the idea that Muslims have come from the West and slowly encroached on Buddhist or in other countries, Hindu lands by force. So I think all of that kind of the impact of colonialism and what happens after colonialism, where does everyone fit in afterwards, plays a big role in what has happened and how different groups have been seen.
So there was one mass movement, enforced mass movement in the 1970s, and then people returned, and then what happened?
Well, people were returned and not necessarily under great conditions. Rations were reduced by the Bangladeshi authorities at the time. And a lot of people died from hunger and illness. And so they were basically forced back. And then things got much worse. They still had citizenship and were kind of officially recognized as the state if they had the right papers in 78. In 82, they were stripped of that citizenship through a law which just excluded them as one of the races of Myanmar. That really just allowed continuous stripping away of rights, of their ability to move, to be educated, to access healthcare. And a big thing by the 90s is like forced labor. The military is completely kind of has complete control of the region, Rakhine State. And the Rohingya, mostly men, are called up to kind of carry stuff for the army, to just be their laborers or build or whatever, or even just, I've heard so many cases of them kind of being human shields for them, just asked to walk in front of them while they're doing military operations. So many people didn't come back alive. So that leads eventually to another military operation in the early 90s and many people again fleeing. A lot of them are Rohingya women with their children because their husbands are in with the military. They've been taken for forced labor and they don't know if or when they will come back, and they're worried about what will happen to them in their absence. So you just end up with another exodus to Bangladesh, and this was about 250,000 this time. It significantly increased. Again, similar pattern. Conditions are made difficult. Repatriation agreements are signed with Myanmar and they start sending people back. They send people back by force. They shipped them onto boats. In other cases, consent was very questionable. It was either done in English or Bengali that they don't understand, or I've heard of kind of mass consent, being told you're going and if you don't say no, then you agree. I met one woman who has been now in Bangladesh 3 times. She was very young the first time, who her son died of a respiratory illness in the camps. Because it was monsoon season, she just had tarpaulin over them. There was no healthcare. So the camps were really horrible. And a significant number, more than half, were sent back during that period over the next few years. But not everyone. Those people who did remain are the people I met in 2015 when I first started reporting in the camps. And those are the people that made me want to focus on the history.
So tell me how you went from reporting on this for a news agency to deciding that you needed to write a book about it.
I think it was that trip in 2015. If you go back to that time, there is talk about boats and refugees in the media, but it's in Europe, in the Mediterranean. It's a bigger crisis there. But I'm living in Bangladesh. And we've been seeing these boats capsizing or being turned back at once they've arrived in to port, turned back by navies and pulled back out to sea.
So these are boats taking Rohingya people from Bangladesh to Malaysia or Indonesia?
Yeah.
People who are trying to flee the appalling conditions in the camps and build themselves a better life in another exile.
Yeah, from both the camps and from Myanmar. And so we see these isolated reports and they're kind of just reported as a boat going down or a boat being pulled out to sea. And there's not so much investigation into what's behind that. There is some. There's some great Thai and Malaysian journalists and others who did some of that, but there wasn't a significant amount. Until 2015, Thailand finds mass graves. Those graves are in basically the trafficking camps where they used to hold people for ransom. They would take them from Myanmar and Malaysia, hold them for ransom in a Thai jungle. And only once their families had paid a ransom, would they take them into Malaysia, which is where they wanted to go. And the discovery of the mass grave kind of put a spotlight on the issue. Thailand had to act. People were reporting. But most journalists were in Thailand or Malaysia. And so there was a lot of focus on what was happening on that end, on the people arriving. I was living in Bangladesh at the time, so I was able to go to the Bangladeshi camps and actually see who were the families whose relatives were missing and why were they leaving Bangladesh? They weren't just leaving Myanmar, but okay, I think by this point people understand Myanmar is an extremely tough place to live, but Bangladesh is supposed to be the safe place. And so in 2017, I decided then that I wanted to write a book, but when I spoke about it, people's eyes glazed over. There wasn't much recognition of like who the Rohingya were or why this was important. Until 2017, the really big massacres, the military operation that forced more than 700,000 people to leave. This is by far the biggest military operation ever. And everyone rushed to Bangladesh at that time.
At that point, you realized that you would be able to get people interested in reading a book about it. Before then, you weren't sure? Because you described very powerfully the world's indifference to this subject at a number of points in your book.
Before that, I had been working on it. I had been working on it in the background, going to archives and trying to build up the historical side of it, trying to understand the history. This question of who are the Rohingya, where are they from? Because there's so many allegations about, well, they're just Bengalis that the British brought, or maybe even that they're just Bengalis who came in 1971 in the Bangladeshi war. They were refugees and they never left. But 2017 gave somewhat urgency to it. I realized I should do this now. And so I quit my job and decided to freelance so I would have the time to go to Bangladesh to write, because I realized people maybe would be interested now. And before I was still working on it, but there was no real reason to do it now or in a couple of years.
So could you talk about the way that your book is structured makes it incredibly reader-friendly, so that although this is a daunting topic for people who aren't experts in this area, you really cleverly weave the stories of half a dozen people whose lives have been really blighted by this ongoing situation. And it explained different aspects of the fallout, the people who are born in Bangladesh in the refugee camps, the people who are trafficked to Malaysia, the people who tried to remain. Could you tell us perhaps about, is it Mumtaz Begum, who really illustrates the awfulness of what happened in 2017. Could you tell us a bit about who she is and how you met her?
Mumtaz is kind of really, her story is illustrative of the tragedy of the Rohingya. She lived in a village called Tolotoli, which is now notorious for being probably the worst massacre of 2017. They were convinced by their local administrator, who was from the Rakhine ethnicity, not Rohingya, that they would be safe and that they should stay despite seeing evidence of violence in the other villages. And the next morning they were attacked, surrounded, and it was very difficult to escape. She was trapped by the riverside. Her children were killed, her husband was killed, and she was raped by soldiers and trapped into a burning home with one of her daughters, which she luckily managed to escape. She then went to Bangladesh, well, she was taken to Bangladesh. She woke up in Bangladesh and she thought all her family were dead. She kind of has to just make her way. The camp by this point has already become the big world's largest refugee camp. It's must have been so intimidating to just look at this quite desolate landscape.
So how many people were living there at that point?
By this point, it's close to a million. And she has to deal with all of, on one hand, the trauma of what has happened. On the other hand, actual physical injuries, because she has scars all across her body. Her life was saved, but treatment afterwards is difficult to access. But she eventually, through kind of people seeing her and seeing that she needs help, is led towards a part of the camp where other people from her village have settled, Tolotoni have settled. She finds one of her sisters, her younger sister who lived further away. Her auntie is there. And then a few months later, ends up finding another sister, Dilda, who almost exactly the same thing happened to. And they both fought each other dead. They had settled in different camps. And when I find her, it's through Yasin, who was like a local Rohingya guy who had kind of just stumbled into like working with journalists. He spoke good English. He'd like done like informal studies. He had been at Sitwe University until the riots, and then they weren't allowed to study at Sitwe University anymore. So he lived near Mumtaz. And so he introduced me to her. She was someone who was interviewed and photographed by a lot of people because her story was so striking and people came to know her story. The issue was almost no one came back to her. I still see her or her sister's photos on like charity billboards now. They're kind of used as the face.
I think one of the most shocking things for me was understanding about the complicity of the UN, some of the international NGOs and the Bangladeshi state in the refugees' plight. I mean, could you talk a little bit about the ongoing rationing of refugees' food, which kind of sounds almost incredible as an external observer?
The Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh have basically been made almost totally reliant on food aid, on what they are given. They're not allowed to work, so they have to wait for rations or for a kind of food card with a certain amount of money that they can spend. But they have to spend it within food distribution centers. They can't go to a market. So the prices are inflated and they have a very limited choice. This means it's a really basic diet that they live on. It's rice, lentils, oil, and maybe they can fit some vegetables into their diet. They're unable to add more to that. They're unable to be fully nourished. And so they have to rely on food aid. And food aid was reduced because the WFP says it hasn't had enough funding. So the Rohingya response has suffered successive cuts since 2017, almost immediately after 2017. And COVID made things worse. The British aid cuts in 2021 significantly impacted the Rohingya. So they are really kind of, I don't really like to say they're helpless, but they don't have many options, which is what they want. They don't want to be reliant on food aid, but no one's allowing them to do anything else.
I was incredibly struck by your description of Trump's ignorance about the situation. Could you just quickly tell that anecdote? Because I think it really sums up how widespread that ignorance and indifference is, particularly given that Trump was president at the height of all of this crisis.
And so there was a Rohingya kind of civil society leader called Mohibullah, who unfortunately has been assassinated since, but he really struggled to ensure that Rohingya had a voice in international platforms. And it got to the point where the UN and others were willing to fly him out and speak to the UN Human Rights Council and to speak to Trump, because Trump's administration organized this meeting of various minorities around the world.
It's such a surreal scene that you describe, of this kind of lineup of people queuing to be given a few seconds to explain to Trump, you know, how they've been persecuted.
Yeah, so it's Trump facing a camera and all of them standing behind and around him. You know, like when you see people, a reporter doing like a piece to camera and everyone surrounding, a crowd surrounding them, and just waiting for their turn to say a few seconds. It's literally seconds about who they are and what's happening to them. And so you go through Uyghurs, Cubans, Yazidis. And when Mohibullah, he gets his few seconds and Trump kind of says, he says, "I'm a Rohingya," and Trump says, "Where's that?" Even though he was president when Myanmar's military operations happened. And I think you can really see how disappointed he is, because one of his team who traveled with him later, I met him afterwards and it's just like, he's really stupid. He was just like kind of shocked, I think, by how a president could be so ignorant.
What is it that you're hoping that your book will achieve? I mean, are you battling against this indifference?
I think so still. But I think because of what has been happening in the UK, there has been some interest in a story that is about people traveling by boats to find some safety and some security. And so I hope there's some empathy that people can tap into. I think there's something that comes from this as well. In the UK, they talk a lot now about human rights being the problem, the barrier. But Bangladesh and Malaysia don't recognize the UN Refugee Convention. That hasn't stopped trafficking at all. It's fueled really horrible trafficking that extremely exploitative. They don't just take them from one place to another. They take them to places elsewhere and hold them hostage until they can pay, and then only then release them. And it doesn't matter to them whether they die, whether the boat goes down, or they get illnesses. So I think there's a lot to learn about certain things the government are saying about human rights being a challenge. I've learned a lot about what happens when a people is abandoned, when there seems to be very little geopolitical interest in solving the problem. The Southeast Asian nations don't like interfering in each other's business, so they don't want to get involved. They don't want to upset Myanmar. Only Malaysia has said some warnings to Myanmar, but the others don't get involved. The West has not shown that much interest in a kind of real solution for the Rohingya. So they're essentially abandoned. It seems to be okay to the world that the Rohingya mostly do not live in their home country, mostly live in refugee camps in Bangladesh, and that they're not being killed in those refugee camps. So that's okay. But what happens if you allow that to be the status quo? They're exploited. Drug dealers who traffic drugs between Myanmar and Bangladesh and to outside use them as carriers for their drugs because they're expendable to them. Traffickers try to get them onto these journeys, or before 2015, even kidnapped them to fill the boats. It's not all people wanting to go to another country and then being tricked. It's sometimes by force, being kidnapped and then being asked for a ransom or being sold on. Or you have them being go to other countries to do labor, but being ending up in detention camps. It's, if you don't solve these issues, you have a people who are just completely vulnerable to exploitation in a way that kind of, and you see that whichever route they have tried to take to get some kind of safety and security, there is exploitation on that route. And the other thing I think is to understand the UN and humanitarian system's failures, because there was so much money put in 2017. And a lot of it spent on hotels and cars, transporting sometimes one person. But also, one of the reasons I was interested in doing emphasizing the history was because I found humanitarian workers who didn't know the history at all, who thought there weren't really any refugees in Bangladesh until 2017. That's worrying because the UN has a worrying role in that history, especially in the 1990s, with their own investigations to reinforce repatriations. And I feel like that should be a bigger deal. I think it goes back to another issue, which as a global development reporter at The Guardian, I come across a lot in the Mediterranean, in other humanitarian responses, is once a country starts pushing the UN and starts putting in negative policies against a refugee population it hosts, the UN and humanitarian system often find it very hard to respond. I think there's a question here of what does the humanitarian system do? Does it just provide shelter and food, or does it have a right to protect people to ensure they're not forced back to other countries unsafely?
I mean, I think your book should be required reading, not just for Trump, but for people working in the NGO sector and for UN employees. This show ends every week by asking the guest about one source or text, be that a film or a book or something else that influenced the book. What would you like to highlight?
It would probably be the Facebook pages of the Rohingya I met in 2015. It might be unusual, but I learned so much from them. It was my way of keeping in contact and seeing what they are thinking, because I can ask them questions. As a journalist, I can see something happening in the news and ask them questions, or I can read what others have read about them. But those are all prompted by what I think is going on. Their Facebook pages showed me what they were thinking, what concerned them every day. And they were very expressive.
That's so interesting. I'm sure that's why your book is such a kind of humane bit of writing and provides such an insight into the lives of the people who you've written about. Afterwards is produced by George McDonough. Thank you to Kamil Ahmed for taking part in this episode. You can order a copy of I Feel No Peace now from the Hearst Publishers websites. For more, follow Hearst at Hearst Publishers, Kamil at Kamil Ahmed, and me at Amelia Gentleman on Twitter. And to get news on the latest Hearst books, subscribe to their email updates at hearstpublishers.com. I'm Amelia Gentleman. Thank you for listening.